It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Ainsley Earhart.
I'm Brett Baer.
I'm Katie Pavlich, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, March 16th, 2023. I'm Lisa Brady. A written statement from a possible Republican candidate makes waves, but it's a long way to 2024.
I don't think this is just going to be Trump and DeSantis. I think you will see other candidates have their moments as we go through this presidential primary.
I'm Chris Foster. More signs that prices may be coming down.
What we really got to see after this much inflation is broad-based, strong declines in price increases. We've seen some of it.
We're speaking with Fox Business host Brian Brenberg.
And I'm Doreen Denny. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
An unmanned U.S. surveillance drone worth more than $30 million is at the bottom of the Black Sea after a confrontation with Russian fighter jets Tuesday.
I just got off the phone with my Russian counterpart.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the start of yesterday's Pentagon briefing criticizing Russia for a pattern of unsafe and unprofessional behavior in international airspace.
As I've said repeatedly, it's important that great powers be models of transparency and communication. And the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows.
The U.S. says the Russian jets harassed the drone, dumping fuel on it before hitting its propeller, damage that ultimately forced its ditching into the ocean. Russia denies any impact with the drone. This as the U.S. repeats continued support for Ukraine in its fight against Russia's invasion. Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley says it's not just about Ukraine.
This is and remains a Russian frontal assault on the rules-based international order that has been in place for 80 years, 8 decades since the end of World War II.
And the defense secretary says he expects bipartisan support to continue, answering a question on whether election rhetoric could undermine support for Ukraine in Congress or with the American public. This as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, considered a possible presidential candidate, faces a flurry of pushback from fellow Republicans after suggesting to Fox's Tucker Carlson the conflict isn't a vital national interest for the U.S.
Yeah, it went beyond that. He also said that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was a mere territorial dispute, as if it was like the conflict between, you know, Israel and the Palestinian territories.
Fox News Radio political analyst Josh Krasauer.
That line in and of itself raised red flags, certainly among Republican hawks, but through among Republican senators ranging from Mitch McConnell to John Thune to Marco Rubio, who knows Ron DeSantis very well as his in-state senator. So, yes, this was a very, very risky move for DeSantis to side seemingly with the more isolationist MAGA wing of the party, given that Trump is already dominating with that constituency. And there are a lot of certainly donors, but also a lot of hawkish voters that are more in the middle of the Republican Party ideologically, who probably are, you know, wondering what DeSantis is up to with that change in his foreign policy views.
Is it bad timing for that kind of criticism as well, given this drone incident that just happened with Russia?
Oh, it certainly is. It raises questions about DeSantis's electability as well, because DeSantis's big pitch is that he's a more electable version of Donald Trump. But look, when you risk being seen as soft on Vladimir Putin, that is not good general election politics. You're opening yourself up to an attack from Democrats. And, you know, even in a Republican primary, DeSantis's biggest strength in the polling right now is among Republicans who call themselves somewhat conservative, more pragmatic conservatives. So throwing red meat to the MAGA base may be part of his strategy to compete on the right with Trump, but it also jeopardizes the voters that have looked at him so favorably throughout the process.
Is it possible that if U.S. support for Ukraine wanes, at least in terms of spending so much money, for instance, could it then become a winning position, though, that DeSantis has kind of lined up for next year?
I mean, insofar as spending money to help the U.S. defend Ukraine, that's only a concern right now among the MAGA wing of the Republican Party. You know, if we had troops in Ukraine, if there was a threat of a nuclear war or something along those lines, then certainly the politics could change. But right now, it's really a matter of whether we support funding the military efforts against Russia and helping our ally Ukraine in fending off the invasion and aggression from Russia. And that has widespread support, not just among Democrats, but among both independents and a whole lot of Republicans, too. So this is an issue that you never want to be the party that's divided on an issue. And on the issue of Ukraine right now, Democrats are largely united. Independents are much closer to the Democrats' position. And DeSantis has now sided with the more isolationist faction of the Republican Party against its own leadership.
Well, given that foreign policy questions, although right now, as you say, it's mainly Ukraine, but given that foreign policy questions are divisive for the Republican Party, wouldn't it be better for Republicans to focus on President Biden's handling of the economy or the border, for instance? Or, you know, is that stuff that just has to wait for the general next year once we get past a GOP primary?
That's right, that it would have been smarter politics for Ron DeSantis not to say anything controversial, to just show support for the American effort against Russia and deal with the details later on and focus on issues that play more to his advantage, whether it's the economy or whether it's taking on, you know, wokeness, progressive excess in his home state of Florida. Those are issues where he has an advantage, both over Trump in a primary and potentially in a general election against Joe Biden. Ukraine is an issue, foreign policy is an issue that's dividing the Republican Party now. And for DeSantis to take such a heterodox, controversial position that divides folks like McConnell, Rubio, Cotton, John Thune on one side and Trump and DeSantis on the other is only hurting the party and their ability to defeat Joe Biden in 2024.
In a hypothetical matchup, former President Trump has widened his lead, 14 points ahead of Governor DeSantis in a new Quinnipiac poll of Republican-leaning voters. The same survey gives President Biden a 4-point edge over Trump, but just 1 point over DeSantis, the only Republican with double digits besides Trump in that Q poll, even though he's not a candidate yet.
He's on his book tour. He was in Iowa last week. He is certainly making all the moves you would expect for anyone looking to run for president. But Ron DeSantis is sort of the Rorschach test in the Republican Party as the leading vehicle for folks who want an alternative to Donald Trump. So everyone from the moderate Republicans to even a few, you know, some MAGA Republicans like what they see in DeSantis, but it is sort of a Rorschach test reflecting their own views, their own ideologies. And once DeSantis has to be a candidate, if he runs, and once he takes positions on these issues like he did this week on Ukraine, he threatens to lose some of that support when people may, you know, end up disagreeing with where he stands on issues that he hasn't dived into yet.
Why do you think he hasn't formally jumped in yet? And for that matter, why do you think President Biden hasn't officially taken the plunge yet?
Well, for DeSantis, he wants to focus on his Florida legislative session and get some significant achievements on the issue of education, first and foremost, on his list of successes. So that makes sense. I think the challenge, though, for DeSantis is that he is not responding to Trump's attacks, to attacks from other Republicans. So like, it's one thing to, you know, it's fine not to be a candidate until the Florida legislative session is over, politically speaking. But I think he's leaving himself vulnerable to these criticisms, which he's not responding to effectively. Biden is sort of in the opposite situation because he's president. He doesn't need to run a campaign aside from raising money. So he wants to be seen as doing the job as president and not getting involved in a tit for tat in terms of the 2024 politics. So, I would expect Biden to announce when most presidents have announced their reelection bids. April or May has been the traditional timetable. And I would expect that Biden would announce in that same time frame.
What about the Republican challengers who are already in the race officially? Nikki Haley, Vivek Ramaswamy, Are they doing the right thing by giving themselves more time to get their message out, or are they just leaving themselves more vulnerable to damage from Trump attacks?
Well, they as far as Nikki Haley goes, I mean, she is not polling nearly as high as DeSantis is, and she's spending more time in these early primary states like Iowa and New Hampshire and trying to do what kind of the underdog candidates tend to do and hoping they can catch fire in the Iowa caucuses or the New Hampshire primary and use that as a springboard for later success. And you also have a lot of other candidates that haven't announced yet, but are certainly thinking about running. And there are a lot of big names in that mix, including former Vice President Mike Pence and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Governor Chris Sununu of New Hampshire. So I don't think this is just going to be Trump and DeSantis. I think you will see other candidates have their moments as we go through this presidential primary.
What do you make of President Biden's apparent move to the center, at least on some things, most notably approving the Willow oil drilling project in Alaska, although the administration tried to emphasize they're reducing the size of it? Still angers a lot of his base, though. At the same time, he signed an executive order aimed at limiting gun violence. Is he trying to, you know, foster broader appeal among Americans in general right now?
Oh, I mean, he is running for re-election. I mean, even though he has not announced his campaign for re-election, his pivot to the center on the Willow project in Alaska, his decision not to veto an overturning of the DC crime code, and speaking out against the DC legislation that would reduce penalties for violent criminals. Those are clear signs that Biden is preparing for re-election and knowing he has to move to the middle. And maybe he even sees an opportunity with Trump and DeSantis both competing for the MAGA right. He certainly sees an opportunity to claim space in that swing center of the electorate that went for the Democrats in 2022 and was key in allowing Democrats to retain the Senate and keep their losses in the House fairly low. And he wants to run the same playbook in 24 as being, you know, maybe people have their concerns about his record or his age or the economy. But when you contrast with the Republican Party, he's hoping that, you know, the Republican Party is seen as too extreme and he's making moves to run to the political center.
Do you think these latest decisions that he's made are an indication that he's confident he would not face a Democratic primary?
Look, yes. I mean, I think Biden and the DNC both changed the calendar to marginalize New Hampshire, eliminate Iowa as one of the early voting states, and put states that are more favorable to the president at the front of the line, like South Carolina. So, you know, look, I think it's very possible that he faces a credible progressive primary challenger, but being the incumbent president and having all those advantages that entails makes it very hard to see him losing the nomination, even if he does get some competition.
Fox News Radio political analyst Josh Krossauer, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
This is Doreen Denny with your Fox News commentary coming up.
More signs that inflation is cooling off this week. Consumer prices still going up, but more slowly for the eighth straight month. 6% annual inflation in the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index. That's the slowest in a year and a half. But that's still 6% higher prices than we're paying a year ago.
You're watching what we're buying a little more carefully. No extravagant anything and a little less travel. Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, we don't eat a lot of beef. Yeah, and we don't go out a lot either.
They're in Tampa, Florida. Stephanie Herbig owns the Cheeky Bird Women's Boutique in Kansas City, Missouri.
I have to be a little bit more thoughtful about what my consumers are wanting and where I'm spending the money.
The wholesale prices she might pay before products get to us were actually lower in February, slightly. The producer price index down 0.1%. Year over year, wholesale inflation comes in at 4.6%, down from 5.7%.
That's a good indicator that inflation generally is coming down. Really, it's welcome to see producer prices come down because they've been very, very high. So that is a good sign.
Brian Brennberg's the co-host of The Big Money Show on Fox Business.
Now, you got a long way to go still, and a lot of that was helped, again, on the energy side of things, especially with like fuel oil coming down. But you need those kind of numbers. The Fed needs those kind of numbers, because if they don't start getting that really fast, their job gets really complicated.
I understand that the Fed looks more closely, among other things, at producer prices than they do consumer prices, just because it's a better leading indicator that you can predict better a month, 2 months, 3 months into the future, looking at that number, right?
Yep. Yeah, they do. I mean, they look at all of it, but they like to get down to the things that they feel like aren't noisy. And they think producer prices are a little less noisy than consumer prices. So, yeah, this is a really nice number for them. And if you kind of put it in a larger context, I mean, with everything the Fed's trying to sort through now, from banking crises to inflation, they need some good news on inflation. As a consumer, as somebody at home, you're really not going to notice these numbers and what you're paying, because remember, we're talking about increases based on increases we saw last year, or in this case, a slight decrease on increases. So don't expect prices at the on the shelf to come down. This is more what might be coming down the pipeline in terms of slowing price increases.
The Great American Egg Crisis appears to be abating. Those prices that were really, I mean, they're still much higher than they were a year ago, but they dropped 36%, I think, month to month.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and this is one that was driven in a lot of ways by avian flu and a lot of factors like that. But I tell you, this is welcome. I know in our own household, we were getting so sick of how much we were paying for eggs. So it's nice to see that come down. But again, that's sort of one data point. What we really got to see after this much inflation is broad-based, strong declines in price increases. We've seen some of it, but one could argue getting from like 9% to 6% is a lot different than getting from 6% to 2%.
Right. Those last four are going to be a lot tougher.
Four are tough because, and I'll tell you why really quickly, because you start to get into this scenario like we have now where the economy starts to look like it's clunking a little bit, again, with the banking stuff. And that's where it becomes hard for policymakers to stay on the path of price reduction, because now they're starting to feel like, should we keep fighting price increases, or should we be worrying about banks?
Right.
And that's where inflation tends to take a back seat. So we're really getting into the meat of that fight now.
Yeah. I mean, I assume if you're the Fed, you're a little bit less worried than what people are paying for eggs than you are about dominoes falling in the banking sector.
Yeah. I mean, and I guess in one sense, rightfully so. But if you look across time in history, what you often see is the fight against inflation takes a really long time and is often unsuccessful. And one of the reasons is because when you fight inflation, other things break. And that becomes a question of, can politicians and bureaucrats stay the course? We're in that moment right now. And, the question is wide open.
Yeah. I mean, you want people to still be getting hired, but not too many people getting hired. You mentioned noise in between wholesale and the shelves.
Yeah.
I saw a thing or two on Fox Business this week about, I think they called it excuseflation. Are we at a point where we can get mad at some companies are some companies hiding behind the cover of inflation to keep their prices high?
Yeah, I think some are being opportunistic. They're saying this is a moment where I can raise prices with the least amount of blame possible. So yes, I do think some of them are saying this is my moment to raise prices. But I think a lot of them are saying also, hey, I don't know where things are going to go over the next 6-12 months. I mean, producer prices are coming down a little bit, but does that keep up? Do we get other snarls in the supply chain? So some of them are really just saying, I'm going to do what I can now to plan ahead in a way. Remember, businesses can't upset consumers too much because consumers trade away and they trade down.
Right.
And we've seen plenty of that. So it's a delicate game that they play. But I do think it's the case businesses are saying, look, you make hay when the sun shines. And right now, the price increase sun is shining, and we're going to do what we can without angering consumers too much.
Well, I mean, I guess it's Econ 101, where you're going to charge what you can charge. And that's that. Now, it's not like gas prices are very often a dollar cheaper than they were a year ago.
Yeah.
If you know, up and down, but things like food, like I remember years and years ago, a can of tuna generally was six ounces,
right?
Became five, didn't go back to six. Is it ever the case that broader consumer goods, once it's there, it's there?
yeah, we kind of get locked. Expectations are set. And if you think about it from the business perspective, if people have gotten used to 5 ounces of tuna instead of six,
right,
keep giving them 5 ounces of tuna. So things would have to radically change in the other direction. I mean, we'd have to get massive, massive growth and a lot of consumer money out there for businesses to say, you know, we've got to increase the size of these things again. I don't think that's going to happen. So you're right. We're kind of getting to a new normal. Your tin of biscuits is going to be this big instead of this big. And that's just the reality of what's happened. I mean, that's the permanent result of what's happened over the last 2-3 years.
I mean, it's funny looking at these consumer inflation numbers over the last whatever year, year and a half, where just because inflation is up 9%, 6%, whatever it is, doesn't mean that your personal grocery bill is up 9 or 6%.
Oh,
because you adjust. Like you said, you trade down. If eggs are really expensive, maybe you buy something else.
Well, and the thing about it is that 9 or 6% number is based on some basket of goods that the economic authorities sort of choose to measure. But your basket may have your basket may have a ton of eggs. And so you're not dealing with 6% inflation. You've been dealing with much more than that. Your basket may have a ton of gasoline in it because of where you live and how many kids you have and what kind of car you drive. On the other hand, you might not have been feeling this quite as much because you don't buy the things where the prices have really exploded. So, yes, and it's also true to your point that you've made adjustments. I mean, you're just not eating the things that you were eating before. And so you've cut a little bit. But this average does not always reflect what people at home are actually dealing with.
Early on into the spikes in inflation, a lot of talk about supply and demand. Because of COVID, things shut down, things ramped back up, but the production wasn't there yet. Are we back to 2019 yet?
No, we're not back to 2019. We're better than we were in 2020, 2021. We're getting better, but you got to remember there's still a ton of businesses out there that are just like dying for workers, basically.
Yeah.
You know, they can't find it. We have a low unemployment rate. We have a low participation rate, which means there's still just not a lot of people out there raising their hand saying, I want to work. And so for a lot of businesses, they're having to adapt to that. So we're not in the worst of it, but we are not humming. The supply chain is still not humming, especially on the services side because of the worker problem.
How much slack is there in that participation rate? If a lot of it, my understanding, is that those are people who during the pandemic said, you know what, I'm done. I think I can retire
early
now.
Early retirement, before planned retirement, yeah.
Right, and maybe now they're working a little, but not as much as, but not full time, or not at all. They just decided here my priorities are different, and I'm off the wheel.
It's tough in a world like ours where you've got the biggest generation retiring, you know, and the succeeding generations are not as big. So you kind of need those baby boomers out there. We're seeing some signs that they're coming back actually because financial conditions have gotten tighter. So I do think there's some slack. I mean, I'm not saying that retirees want to come back and work. But I do think some of that will happen as financial conditions remain tight. But overall, it is a big problem. And I want to just point this out, too. You know, pandemic policy has been to have the federal government spend a lot of money on people to help them pay the rent, to help them buy food, et cetera. And that, on the margin, keeps people on the sidelines. So until that really kind of goes away, this problem persists.
That still hasn't exhausted itself yet?
No, I mean, it still hasn't. No, you've still got, you know, again, if you look at like supplement and nutrition programs, for example, enrollment in those is still massive. Okay. Student loans, students still aren't paying those loans back. So you really got to see that go away to change the incentives where people say, you know, those 10 million jobs that are available, I got to go take one or two.
Yeah. Retail sales were down last month. Anything to see there? Is that prices falling or is that people shopping less?
Well, I do think it's consumers adjusting. Yeah, you get past kind of the binge of Christmas and in the beginning of the year. It doesn't surprise me. I mean, it just costs a lot of money to borrow money now. So, and if you're buying stuff on borrowed cash, you're not going to do that as much. So I do think that, by the way, that's the number that the Fed's looking for. I mean, they will look at that and say, oh, good, thank goodness that takes pressure off of us. But it starts to raise that question of if you've got an exhausted consumer and that keeps up, are you talking about recession?
Right.
Okay. Because the consumer powers the economy. So you flip kind of from one set of risks to another. But this, eventually, you're going to see that when interest rates keep going up like they are and indebtedness keeps rising, which it is.
Better than me, man. I don't know how you walk that tightrope. Finally, this week, more Meta layoffs, a lot. Another 10,000. There was 11,000 layoffs late last year. They're not going to fill 5,000 open jobs. They're going to drop a bunch of projects. Is this a pandemic hangover thing? Did they overhire?
Yeah, I think this is one of those. The binge is over, and now you're feeling the effects of that. I mean, these guys were living in a world that none of us had seen, and the possibilities sort of looked endless. I mean, their business could grow and stay huge indefinitely if some of the pandemic stuff caught on.
Yeah.
What they're finding is people are sort of going back to normal, and they overhired, and they hired in the wrong spots.
Right.
And so they're making some changes. It's painful for them. I mean, truthfully, this is what a lot of tech companies need to do. It's probably a good sign from a business perspective that they're figuring this out and doing something about it. But these are companies that really never cut jobs before. The culture always was growth and good times. They're living in a very different reality.
Brian Brenberg, Associate Professor of Business Economics at King's College, the King's College in New York City, more relevant to my purposes, co-host of Fox Business's The Big Money Show. That's weekdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, along with Jackie DeAngelis and Taylor Riggs.
Yes.
Brian, good to meet you, man.
Thanks.
Meet the American who
was the first to achieve sainthood.
Elizabeth Ann Bailey was born in New York City in 1774 to a prominent Episcopal family. She was a child of the American Revolution and possessed the same qualities its leaders had, faith, foresight, and fortitude, that from author Anne Merwin. Elizabeth married William McGee Seton in 1794, and the couple had five kids. When her husband died during a trip to Italy, leaving her a young widow at the age of 30, Elizabeth was taken in by a Catholic family there. When she got back to the U.S., she converted to Catholicism. The New York City establishment, however, shunned her for this, so she moved to Maryland with her kids. There, she pioneered Catholic education and founded the nation's first convent. Elizabeth Seton is also credited with at least three miracles. She cured a child of leukemia, cured a woman of cancer, and cured a man of a rare brain infection. Timothy Cardinal Dolan, Archbishop of New York, told Fox News Digital about Elizabeth Seton, saying, quote, "She was a strong, independent woman, a socialite from a very respected family, and a patriot very interested in the events of the day and the fight for independence of a new nation." Mother Elizabeth Ann Seton died in 1821, but her legacy lives on in education institutions, including Seton Hall University and the Sisters of Charity Communities. She was canonized in 1975. During that ceremony, Pope Paul VI said of her, "Elizabeth Ann Seton was a holy American. Rejoice for your glorious daughter." I'm Gianna Gelosi. Go to the lifestyle section of foxnews.com for more of these incredible American stories.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Doreen Denny.
What's on your mind?
In 2021, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA, made more than $1.14 billion in revenues. About 87% came from March Madness, mostly from broadcast rights. No doubt, college sports is big business. Men bring in the money, so it is no surprise the NCAA has doubled down on discriminating against female athletes by prioritizing males to compete in their sports. Female athletes are under attack by an insidious form of sex discrimination, driven by identity politics and condoned by the majority of campus administrators and athletic departments, unwilling to stand up for the rights of their own female champions. They want the trophies and the dollars that come with it. Last year, Americans were awakened to the real March Madness when 6'1" trans-identifying male swimmer Leah Thomas ran away with a national title in women's swimming. What has the NCAA done to reckon with this blatant injustice that sent a shockwave through the sporting world? Unless incoming President Charlie Baker, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts, makes major changes, the answer is nothing except double down on its trans and gender inclusive agenda while distancing itself from any accountability. The NCAA's glitzy new diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, review framework imposes an ideological agenda through college athletic programs. It seeks to do President Joe Biden's bidding in his quest to reclassify sex under Title IX as a matter of identity, not biological reality. Coaches care about winning. So under this new framework, recruiting biological men to be in women's sports will be an advantage. Why not play by the rules and recruit males identifying as women? That will be the trend if we don't have more courageous leaders at universities stand up for their female athletes. These elite college women athletes have trained their whole lives, had their parents drive them to practice before dawn, and attend all of their events, only to watch a male steal their trophy or take their scholarship? Concerned Women for America filed a civil rights complaint against the University of Pennsylvania, and we joined the Independent Council on Women's Sports, female athletes, and other women's rights groups at a rally outside of NCAA's annual meeting this year to petition them to stop discriminating against women. Outgoing NCAA President Mark Emmert bears responsibility for the trans privilege policies denigrating women's sports and discriminating against women. Current NCAA Board of Governors Chair Linda Livingston, the president of Baylor University, has adopted the company line and refused to meet with women's organizations and female athletes facing this discrimination. University of Kentucky champion swimmer Riley Gaines was told she couldn't stand on the winner's podium last year because Thomas must hold the trophy and appear in the pictures. She encountered Emmert after the rally, and as she retells the scene, Mark Emmert claimed he agreed with us about women facing inequity in their own sports. Well, don't insult us. The NCAA may pride itself on pushing an agenda that strips sex from its policies and promotes gender-bending pronoun use as some form of enlightenment. But this is more than institutional elitism. It is proof that its current leadership has no intention of loosening its grip on a trans-inclusive agenda that sidelines college women from sports and forces female athletes to lose their rights and their dignity at the fieldhouse door. After a dozen years of the NCAA pushing this destructive and malicious trans-inclusive agenda, it's time for incoming President Charlie Baker to lead change by recognizing the dignity of women, and particularly female athletes. This is Doreen Denny with Concerned Women for America, the nation's largest public policy women's organization, concernedwomen.org.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. New from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for season 3 of my limited time podcast, Everything Will Be Okay, based on my best-selling book of the same name. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now.
Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.